Okay.
So I was saying that the courses, and I mentioned the National People's Welfare Council and the National Association for Mental Health, as you did. The Institute also made efforts with universities mm-hmm. to lay on short courses, so a number of those were provided, mm-hmm. Not under the aegis of the Institute, but I think they motivated people to lay on different courses for social welfare officers. And then, of course, after the report of the Young Husband Committee, the Institute did press for implementation of that report and did influence the setting up of the National Institute Social Work Training.
Yes.
And I think at the time we actually provided them with the table, the great big oval table at the Institute.
Did you?
We made a contribution to the library, and there was a third thing which I've forgotten what it was. So we made three contributions to the National Institute, and it cost our institute, the Institute of Social Welfare, I know it was well over £1,000 for the table alone, I think.
Yes.
But it was quite a, in our terms, a significant contribution, so that we were fully supportive to that. And then, of course, the first courses were mounted by the new council. But by then I was in South Shields. I know I got someone on the first course, one of the three pilot courses at the North West Polytechnic in London.
Yes.
But that was, we would be coming then into in the early 60s.
60, 61,
weren't we? That's right.
So can
and of course I influenced the Young Husband report very much because I contributed an article which is long forgotten but is mentioned in Peter Townsend's Last Refuge. I had a lot of contact with Peter Townsend when he was writing The Last Refuge, and on page 417 I think it is, he acknowledges an article I wrote, Administrative Principles and the Young Husband Report, which really was saying what we needed was a Seaborn reorganisation.
Really? Yes.
And bringing the different services together. And I did that on the basis of the Machinery of Government Committee, the Haldane Committee report, which, if you're familiar with it, analysed the way in which functions ought to be allocated and services provided.
Is that a pre-war report then?
Oh, 1918. That was a Machinery of Government report. Machinery of Government report concerned with principles of organisation. Yes. And my recollection is there are two main choices. You either organise services on the basis of client groups or you you organise them on the basis of functions to be performed.
Yes.
And my little article was about the organisation on functions to be performed, i.e. social work, inverted commas, or caring services, rather than a client group approach, children, mental illness, elderly. Yes. And that was, I suppose, in 1961, that anyway, Peter, that The Last Refuge is stuck there and it's acknowledged.
The article was 60.
I can't remember. We can check on it afterwards if
you're
interested.
Because you're saying you'd influenced the Young Husband.
Yes, it's really wrong. Is that it's influences Seaborn.
Influences Seaborn.
Yeah, that's right.
And so it's really
that's
the wrong.
Right.
But it grew from Young Husband.
Yes, it did. That's right.
That's very interesting. Have you got a copy of that article?
I have somewhere. I don't know where it is. It's somewhere around.
Well, perhaps when we finish, I can ask you now.
Yeah, yeah. I'll see if I can put my hand on it.
Yes. Yeah. So, can I come back to the Institute of Social Welfare? You were saying about the National People's Council.
Welfare Council.
Right, laid on courses and so on. I wonder whether it's fair to ask you this question, but can you sort of remember what you saw as the training need being? I mean, in terms of content, I mean, was it better understanding of services available or how people tick or actual methods or skills, social work skills? What is it that you were after?
Well, I think we were we'd really recognised people of my age and experience that dealing with people and helping them to come to terms with their disabilities or helping them to make decisions about their future, I mean, that could be related to someone having to make a decision about going into a residential home, demanded the kind of skills and knowledge about human behaviour, motivation, that these were very crucial decisions and required a good deal of skill and knowledge, and that hitherto quite a lot of people working in those settings were almost gaining their experience on the job, and there was far more to it than that. That's not to denigrate the people who are doing the work at all, because I think that they were very caring people, and they were doing their best at the time. But I think there was this realisation of the complexities of the job and the extent to which it was getting more complex with people living longer, with the range of disabilities and the extent to which new technology, even at that time, was helping people, children and adults, to overcome disabilities. It wasn't unrelated to the activities in other fields. I mean, I can remember, for example, when you looked at the registers for the blind, that there was quite a significant number of children on the registers.
Yes.
Now, that was corrected. Very few children on the registers today because of the attack on glaucoma and other conditions, where mainly it was the ophthalmologists and the opticians who were making a contribution in preventive terms. But there was an interesting link with welfare services departments.
Yes.
In pursuing these initiatives, in trying to alert their visiting officers to the indications that someone might require their eyes testing. So that, and this is just one example, that the people working in welfare services were beginning to see that their boundaries were open-ended in a way, that they were linking into other services, and that's a very good example. And I can remember quite a lot of initiatives being taken with blindness and the onset of blindness and the signs that someone might be having difficulty. And in a smaller way, I think it happened with the with other client groups as well, really.
And you mentioned the PSWs a couple of times, and I was wondering when you were just saying just now about an increasing awareness of the complexity of the problems you were dealing with, whether you were influenced by the sort of things PSWs were saying at that time and doing, or that MSWs were doing.
Well, I think we were. I think we and I'm glad you mentioned the MSWs because, again, the Institute of Medical Social Workers and the Psychiatric Social Workers group, I mean, their training was, if you like, a specialised training, and we tended to see those people as skilled people and in short supply, not available, generally speaking, to health and welfare services. And we felt that that sort of experience or something similar to it was required in the community, whereas those people were mainly in institutional settings, excluding the few PSWs in mental welfare services, and there weren't all that many.
That's right.
And excluding the PSWs in child guidance, they were mainly PSWs in child guidance, but numerically it wasn't a significant number. So that the entire focus of training tended to be in institutional settings, and the community was totally lacking in that sort of skill. And I think we realised that.
Yes. And the one or two MSWs went into welfare services, didn't they?
Small number.
Were there any in Lancashire or South Shields?
No, can't remember any. I mean, the people I remember who went into, I mean, the example that comes to mind is the Buckinghamshire one.
Oh, yes.
Where I think under Townsend, I think it was, who I know quite well, the medical officer,
yes,
of Bucks, he brought in the MSWs into his yes, community services.
Yes.
And more or less had a structure of MSWs, I think.
Yes. How many was that? What year would be talking about there?
Oh, I think that would be the '60s, really.
60s, yes. Well. So,
can I just say about another thing? You were talking about the Institute.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting that the Institute, as I say, people who were members of the Institute found their way onto the Young Husband Committee. Mm. Similarly, members of the Institute, along with others, as I did, found their way onto the Williams Committee.
Okay.
Which looked at the training for residential staff.
Caring for people.
Caring for people.
Yes.
So that, I mean, in a sense, when committees were set up to look at particular aspects, mm-hmm, they could only draw on the experienced people around at the time who tended to be active in what you might describe as a voluntary association of people concerned with similar services.
Yes.
And that's how things do evolve, isn't it, really?
Yes.
That you're using experience to build upon and and create new opportunities, new frontiers, really.
Did you and your colleagues in the Institute then sort of come into touch with government, sort of via the civil service? And did you develop informal links with the Ministry of Health and things?
Oh, yes, very much so.
Yes.
Well, I think I would say that through the Institute at that time, we're probably closer links with the permanent secretary of the day than perhaps some professional associations have now. I mean, it's a different setup now, but I can remember people like Sir Bruce Fraser and Arnold France, who were permanent secretaries in their time, coming to Institute meetings.
Yes.
Annual meetings and being very friendly on a very casual basis, listening to some of our views and so on. So there was a good link there. And I think if you ask people who were in the ministry at that time, they would say that they regarded the Institute as a very useful sounding board and the kind of body to proffer advice on a range of matters.
So
as other I mean, it's not the only one in the field, but it happened to be the one that focused upon particularly the welfare services.
I mean, that's really the interesting aspect of social policy, isn't it?
Yes.
And where these informal links, where you drop a little seed into somebody's ear.
That's right.
Can you remember any? I know it's perhaps been tough throwing this at you just now. I mean, can you remember sort of any seeds that flowered that you or you saw somebody else at the bar? So,
well, I don't know. I don't know that I could sort of realistically put a finger on anything like that. There was one personal experience, I think, but you're never sure what influence there was about this, but this was about the Undersecretary was very much involved in was an observer on the Seaborne Committee. I mean, I wasn't on it because they were careful not to draw anyone from interested parties on Seaborne.
Yes.
Sometimes it's criticised because of that.
Yes.
But there was a point at which there was all this business going on about the Kilbrandon Committee in Scotland. And a particular undersecretary had heard me say that we oughtn't to go in one particular direction, which would have meant mental welfare services finishing up under the aegis of the medical umbrella.
Oh, yes, which they were lobbying for.
That's right.
Yeah.
My word, I could talk about some of these conflicts with the medics, but I wouldn't like to identify. But, I mean, my life's been full of that.
Yes.
Working in health and welfare and seeing as an advisor to the AMC, as it was then, the pressure of the medical officers, even at the last, almost the last phase of implementing CBOM, almost within hours, it was uncertain as to whether mental health would go with health or stay with social services. And it was on this particular point that an undersecretary, I don't think I ought to say who it was really, asked me up to lunch at the Athenaeum and said, come on, I've got a paper to write, I've got to head this off in some way. And it was related to Kilbrandon as well, and he was bringing in Kilbrandon, and he was, it was really, I suppose, a departmental brief he was preparing. And I think to some extent, perhaps, that could have had an influence on the eventual outcome. But I mean, that might just be my ego coming to the fore. But you, as you say, you never know, do you? And undersecretaries don't invite you to lunch for nothing.
No, that's right, yes.
Expensive lunches at that.
I mean, and sometimes it happens even less explicitly than that.
That's right.
It's what you think has been a casual conversation.
Yes, that's right.
And
yes.
They're taken away and made use of that.
Yes, that's true.
Can you think of any more stories, earlier stories?
Well, I think, I mean, you hear it today, the extent to which some people suggest that sheltered housing is an alternative to residential care. And I think that some of the earlier contacts I had with Peter Townsend helped him to see things a little differently, despite all he found out in his... survey of the last refuge.
I can't remember that.
I don't know, it's stuck there. Just pull the right hand thing. It's a bit stiff, but just pull it. Should pull back, doesn't it? Must do. It's just stiff. I'll unclip.
Switch off the machine.
Yeah, that's right.
So you were saying about how you influenced Peter Townsend's thinking about sheltered housing for the elderly.
Well, I think we tried to disabuse him of the ideas he had that if you provided more and more and more sheltered housing, you wouldn't need residential accommodation.
Yes.
I'm not so sure that he doesn't still adhere to that view, that you could do without residential accommodation. I question that. Because I think some people need that kind of intensive care.
Yes.
But I suppose some experience from other countries suggests that you can manage without it. Although there, you see, when I went to have a look at services in France some years ago where they hadn't very much residential accommodation, what you found was an amalgamation of the sick and the non-sick. As we had pre-48, so that I think it's quite a difficult issue unless you look really across the board. But I mean, judging from the comments made by wardens of sheltered housing, they have an awful job to care for some people these days because of the extent of their frailty and disabilities.
Yes.
So, I mean, I think Peter Townsend's research on residential institutions had an enormous impact on people in the services at that time. And I can remember going to all kinds of meetings and conferences to discuss his report, and I'm sure it had an influence on the design and the practice in many of those establishments. And that influence is still operating today because we've still got residential establishments which are like the curate's egg.
Yes.
Some provide opportunities for residents to make decisions, choices and so on, and others don't.
Yes, right.
Despite the philosophy of a department.
Yes.
I mean, the philosophy in Dorset is major input from residents. Yeah. But you look at individual homes, it all depends on the calibre of staff you've got, the attitudes of staff and so on.
Yes.
Doesn't matter what the department says, really. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Did you ever... you mentioned that article, which Obviously, it had an impact on Peter Townsend and maybe elsewhere for all.
Yeah.
But I wonder whether, have you written any, did you ever write any papers or memoranda that?
I haven't been a prolific writer. I mean, I've contributed odd articles, but I think the main influence I've had would be, for example, when Secretary of the Institute compiling statements of evidence to different committees or bodies. And I suppose in a more remote way, when you're advisor to local authority associations, you're very much involved in commenting about proposals for services and so on, so that I suppose I was advisor to the AMC, as it was then, for about 7 years during the time I was in South Shields and Bromley. I mean, that at that time certainly was an organisation where I think the influence of officers was equal or greater than that of the members. I'm not saying that it is so today, it might be different, but I think it was then.
What did you do as an, I didn't realise that the AMC had
Well, the AMC and the CCA, now the ACC and the AMA, always had advisors to their particular committees, so that, for example, the old Welfare Services Committee had two advisors from directors of welfare services, and I was one for several years. They also had a medical officer of health, so that those authorities where the functions were combined were represented. Similarly, the children's committee would have a couple of children's officers. So that a fire committee would have a couple of fire officers. So that during all those years, whatever came to the AMC in terms of government proposals, the officers had to respond. I mean, it was a very hard life. Being an advisor, and still is, to those who are advisors, it's a very strenuous commitment. The ACC have tried to spread it a bit more in the last 2 or 3 years with having a lead advisor and a group of people he can call on. But over the years, beginning when I was in South Shields, not only did it mean responding to documents which flowed pretty frequently, but also attending meetings of the AMA and representing them in meetings with other bodies, including government departments, voluntary organisations such as the Spastic Society and Royal National Institute for the Blind and the Deaf and so on.
I mean, that makes, it's another sort of...
It's another dimension.
Dimension on
it is really, and again, it's a dimension that, as you said earlier, when you contacted me, there aren't many people around now, I don't suppose, who've about 40 odd years' experience and have different dimensions. I mean, advisor to the AMC, secretary to the institute. I was a member of the Council for Training in Social Work again, because that was an AMC nomination. For several years, was chairman of their committee on residential social work for a short time. I was a member of the committee which looked at epilepsy. It was a joint committee between two advisory committees to ministers, and I was a member of that. So there's a whole range of experience that I've had. That you never know how much influence you exercise. What you're certain about is you pick up a damn sight, you pick up a lot of knowledge. And you can't help it. You pick up a lot of knowledge, and it helps you that to deal with unexpected situations. Strangely enough.
Yes.
I mean, I tend to say, and this again is a bit egotistical, but. It's very rarely a situation arises and you don't know either how to respond to it or where to go to get some specialist advice or some further advice, because you've been around in these circles. And whilst I'm not necessarily linked in, apart from this year as president of ADSS, you know the scene. You know the spheres of influence, you know the bodies of knowledge, right, and so on.
Yes.
And it's fascinating,
yes,
really.
Yes, yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Was South Shields very different from Lane? Because when you went to South Shields, you were
it was
chief
different.
Officer,
I went as Director of Welfare Services, yeah, a more imposing title than Chief Welfare Officer, I thought. And it was an achievement at that time, at 36, I think I was, to become a head of department.
Yeah.
It's fairly common now, I think, because they go for younger people much more, but they didn't in those days, yeah, I don't think. And I went there 57 to 65. They thought I was from the Midlands.
Yes.
They thought Lancashire was in the Midlands. They were very kind, hospitable people. South Shields always struck me as a bit like a parish because it bounded by the Tyne,
yes,
the North Sea.
Yeah.
Everybody seemed to know what everybody else was doing.
Yeah.
Everybody seemed to know everybody else, yeah, even in a town with a population of 100,000.
Yeah.
And I think it was because of these peculiar geographical features.
Yeah.
And what struck me in all the time I was there was the influence in their thinking which the Jarrow March and the Depression had had.
Mm.
They always talked about it.
Mm.
They always related some event to the bad old days of the 30s. And Alan Wilkinson was a household name with everybody in South Shields, and you can understand why, because they'd been through a very traumatic stage. I don't think they've ever come out of it, because when I was there, Lord Hailsham came with his cloth cap image. And I was there when they set up this development council, or whatever they called it, with Chetwynd as the director.
Yes. Yes.
And the North East was going to have new blood, new industries, and so on. And a lot of those aspirations were demolished after a time. New industries came, but they came and went, quite a number of them. But the derision with which Lord Hailsham's visit was associated with, I mean, it was, they talked about that for a long time, the cloth cap image. And you to be acceptable there, they say he's one of us. And I don't think I was ever acceptable in South Shields, but my goodness, my son was, and will be forever because he was born there.
Yes,
very much so.
Yeah.
But and one of the things I always remember about South Shields, when my son was born, and my wife always recounts this story, when she took him out in the pram, she came back and she'd find sixpence of silver coins in the pram, and strangers used to, with a newborn baby, used to drop silver in the...
Gosh.
Yeah, interesting.
Yes.
Customs
yes.
of that area.
Yes.
And I always said of the South Shields of the committee there, that they were prepared to accept any proposal I put up for developing welfare services. They were enthusiastic. The only thing they wouldn't do in South Shields was give you any salary increase. You had to fight for that.
Yes.
But they'd give you anything you wanted with services.
Yes.
Yes. They were...
So did they have a very well-developed service, welfare service then?
Well, I think they had the previous holder of the post. I think he'd been there about 40 years, previously as public assistance officer, so that I was the first new blood they'd had in a long time. And the previous director had it just got to the closure of the public assistance institution, so he'd set up all these small adapted homes dotted around the town, and had done a very good job there, and I suppose my initiative there was concentrated upon domiciliary services, where we had a very intensive visiting scheme round the town, where we had a register at that time of elderly people. I know people criticise registers, you can't keep them up to date, but it was a very extensive visiting scheme, and the authority gave me staff to carry it out. So that it was a scheme of contact, and then we had all sorts of arrangements for, I suppose, were the
precursors of some of the warden schemes with street wardens and so on. But it was that kind of urban area where there was a great deal of interest in providing services, and I remember setting up a work centre there for retired pensioners, a local authority work centre, not a voluntary agency. Things of that sort, where the committee were always very, very, very supportive. And also, I mean, that committee, I know it was on my recommendation, but they did for the first time second a member of their staff to the first social work training course.
Yes,
the Northwest Young Husband course. And then the following year, they, or 2 years afterwards, they sent a second person. So they accepted the importance of training. Now that's interesting for a county borough of that size. Very interesting, because a lot of the authorities, even in that area, wouldn't look at the Young Husband courses for some considerable time, particularly the smaller authorities.
Yes.
Oh, we can't spare the staff. Sort of attitude, but South Shields did. And it, I mean, you can't, a chief officer can't do anything without his committee's support. I mean, whether he gets the support might depend on the way he approaches something.
Yes.
But credit must be given to that authority. For they went along with it.
Yes.
And excellent.
Well, can I ask you two last?
Yeah,
these are the two. I've been asking these to everyone. well, the first one is this. Some rather critical things have been said about social work and social workers during this period, 29-59. I think you have the sort of things Barbara Wootton said and Audrey Harvey said.
Audrey Harvey,
I wonder what you'd say about it, or
Well, I think Audrey Harvey's a bit of a rubbish. She talks rubbish anyway. Audrey Harvey. I don't think Barbara Wootton talked rubbish, but Audrey Harvey. I used to come across her activities when I was in Bromley in London. You see, and she's I mean, quite entitled to her views, but she's a bit like the June Lates and so on. They're way out. In a sense, they could be right.
The
They're way out. I suppose they could be right, but they aren't way out. And I mean, if you're really saying, what do I think about their views about social work? I think some of the views that are presented, they're presented on the basis of incomplete knowledge about what social workers really do. And I think that's one of our failings in departments today, that we haven't really told people, conveyed people what social workers do. We're anxious to convey what they don't do when there's a breakdown and so on. But if you look at the extent to which they've enabled people to get a better quality out of their lives, I think that's sufficient testimony. And I think nowhere is this more evident, I suspect, and I'm leaving the childcare and the elderly services out now, and just using as an illustration the mentally ill and the mentally handicapped, who, but for their intervention, along with others, people in training centres and nurses, I'm not focusing just on them, but a lot of people would still be languishing in hospitals today who are outside managing in the community. So they've had a share, a part in that success story. And we don't talk about it very often, but that's a success story. And if you've been in mental health, as I think you were suggesting, you'll know the extent to which things have moved on that front, whereas they might have moved back on the pre-care and the aftercare front, but they move forward on that shift from hospital to community care. I don't think that answers Barbara Wootton and Audrey Harvey, but it's I think it's a relevant comment.
Yes, absolutely. You might find this one a bit embarrassing, but what do you think the best thing you've done? What is the best thing you've done? You know, in your period in social.
One tends to think of more recent things, I suppose.
Well, it doesn't have to be something, you know, you don't have to confine yourself to the period we've been talking about. I mean, it's just in general.
I think, in a sense, because it's a culmination, I think it's the way in which I've moulded this department together to provide what I think is a caring service, and which is initiated a number of schemes. I think I would look at it in that broad. I think the latest achievement in my terms, it's a total achievement in terms of the department. Here, I think. I mean, it's easy to segregate out of that or any other experience one particular scheme that you think was, my, that was marvellous. I mean, one could focus on a particular capital project, such as a new super duper centre for the handicap, but that's such a narrow focus. And I think the broader focus would be. I came here, I don't think anybody wanted me here in 1970 except the clerk to the county council or the chief executive, and he seemed to be adamant to in appointing a director from outside. But the children's officer didn't want me, the medical officer didn't want me. I had a terrible time, 8 months as designate. I tried to leap away, but nobody would have me. They felt sure I'd done something wrong, wanting to get away from a new Subourne appointment. And from that very lousy, terrible beginning, what I've built up here, and I could only build it because I've got the people around me who've contributed to it, I think is an example of a good service for clients. And I put the clients, I think we provide a good service for clients. But any director would say that, wouldn't they? Really. Is that that's my answer to your question, but it might not be the kind of answer you were wanting.
No, that's okay. But I mean, I know it's always difficult, because virtually asking someone to blow their own trumpet.
Well, do you want me to elaborate a little bit on some of the department's achievements, or not?
Yes. Yes, please. But also, I wondered whether you could take your mind back to earlier stages of your career and think perhaps, that wasn't bad.
Well, let me deal, first of all, with just two examples. The extent to which we moved so many people out of mental hospitals that the psychiatrists were getting worried because they hadn't enough patients to treat. I won't say any more than that. and the extent to which the mentally handicapped, who 10 years ago wouldn't have been thought, you wouldn't have thought they'd have had the potential to live with minimum support in the community, are so living in the community. Despite sometimes the pressure in the opposite direction from their relatives and friends.
Yes.
So my message is that we still underestimate the potential of the mentally handicapped.
Yes.
And one could again point to the kind of unit homes we have and the kind of home health service, which I think is well managed and so on. But I'll leave it at that and then try to go back. Because if I go back to Bromley, let me go back in reverse sequence. I haven't said much about Bromley, but Bromley was an unusual authority. There was a reorganisation problem there. I had to build Bromley from nothing, because I didn't pick up more than one or two staff from Kent because they were down at Maidstone. So I had to set up an entirely new organisation. Now, what my recollection of Bromley, apart from the one or two new capital projects and so on, was the extent to which I had a relationship with voluntary agencies, because Bromley is an authority where you bet your bottom dollar there's every example of what a voluntary agency might be doing. Because it's that sort of area which throws up such a lot of voluntary help. And I think that one of my main achievement there was the relationship I established between the voluntary agencies across a wide range of services and the local authority. Going back to South Shields, I think there, the summarising the contribution there, it will be the extent to which I influence the development of domiciliary services for the client groups I was dealing with, the elderly, not the mental health at that time because they were MOH,
yes,
but the elderly and the physically handicapped and the deaf and the blind.
Yes.
Sometimes the forgotten categories.
Yes.
And Lancashire, well, you've heard enough about Lancashire, haven't you, really? So, that's it, really, I think.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
It's been